Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome to The Food Fight, where we offer a different perspective on food culture issues around Australia and the world.
We'll talk with chefs, producers, business owners and experts to hear their stories and find out what makes them tick.
This episode, we're speaking with sommelier and wine communicator Samantha Payne about the allure of wine and the changing nature of Australia's wine landscape. Welcome to another episode of the Food Fight podcast. My name's Steph Postuma, one of your hosts, along with my co-host, Simon Evans.
Hi.
And we are here today with Samantha Payne, sommelier, wine writer, and communicator at Fix Wine Bar in the City.
Hi, guys.
Thanks for joining us, Sam.
Thanks for having me.
We start our podcast with an acknowledgement of country. We're on Gadigal country here in Sydney, so we'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of the land where we sit today, gather and talk, and pay respect to elders past, present, and emerging. All right, guys, let's start. Sam, this is going to be a wine-heavy podcast, so just to put the alert out there for people, it's great. We haven't done a fully wine-focused podcast since I don't know, ages ago. So,
almost like the pilot episode.
The pilot episode for this podcast where we all just drank heaps of wine and thought it was fun.
And yet we're sitting here drinking sparkling water.
Now drinking sparkling water.
How things have changed,
eh? And yeah, I don't know. There's plenty to talk about. We can nerd out on wine. We can talk about your career, Sam, and what you do. But I'd also sort of like to talk a bit about what it is about wine that's so alluring to people. Like, why do people become so, pardon the pun, intoxicated by wine as an industry and as a beverage and as an idea and everything that goes into it? Because once people go down the rabbit hole, and you both have gone down the rabbit hole, you get stuck. And, I mean, from knowing you, Simon, wine is just as much a part of your life as food is, but you're sort of, people think of you as a chef first, a wine guy second, I guess. Mm. Yeah. So, Sam, do you kind of remember that first experience that you kind of got it when it came to wine and sort of was got a bit hooked?
Yeah, it's funny that we're starting with this question because it's literally how I kickstarted my career. So I was actually doing a degree in art history and English literature because as a kid, the only thing I'd ever loved was art. I wanted to be an art critic. I wanted to be a museum curator. I wanted to paint. I wanted to draw. I wanted to do all of that kind of stuff. So that's what I did at uni and was paying my way by working at Vintage Cellars part-time. Now, this was back in the day before Coles bought them out, and they were basically each store was like each manager's individual cellar. They would buy all the things that they were really interested in or were excited by and all of this kind of stuff. And I had an incredible, mentor and manager Ian, and basically, held my hand and introduced me to all the amazing things that is about wine. So I got to the end of my 4-year degree and went, I'm hooked. I'm in awe of how you take a grape and it becomes part of people's collective experience through winemaking, through viticulture, through, cooking, all of that kind of stuff. So, I got to the end of my degree and went, that's it. I'm going to be a sommelier. I'm going to take, all the things that I had learnt, about art critic and art critiquing and all of that kind of stuff, and was like, I'm going to apply that to wine because it's its own art form in a way. So that's how I got hooked in.
Mm.
So,
did you have any hospitality experience, or is it just vintage cellars at that point?
Just vintage cellars at that point.
So, what is it like when you decide you want to become a SOM? Like, do you get educated on the fact that you're going to be working in hospitality and like the realities of what a hospitality job is?
No, not at all. I just thought I would just walk in with all my wine knowledge yeah. and all my like chutzpah and my sass, and I thought it'd be fine. And they were like, yeah, you've got to carry three plates. And I was like, I'm sorry, what? I have to do what now? No, I can't possibly do that. And they're like, you're gonna have to carry three plates, and you're gonna have to understand how the pass works, and you know all of this kind of stuff. So I actually started as a bar back in my sort of hospitality experience, and then sort of built up from there, and then 12 months later it become head som just through
Where was that?
At the original Manly Pavilion. So yeah, I was part of their opening team.
Yeah,
and
wow.
It was so funny. One of the managers there was like, this will be like a hospitality experience that you'll never experience again in your life. And it was right. Like, we talk about, you know, the beaches and Bondi and Manly being these bubbles, and it was like our own little world there down in Manly. And there was a team of like 35 of us, and it was, you know, Jonathan Barthelmess's first run as sort of executive chef, and his vision and all that, and the team that they'd put together were literally the best of the best at the time. And I could not have asked for a better learning experience for my first SOM job.
That's quite a thing to jump into. Like, opening a venue is always full on.
Yeah.
Especially if you, I mean, did you have expectations of, like, you knew you were what you were getting into?
Had no idea.
To some extent. You knew you weren't going to be, like, you know, running the wine list to start
no,
with.
No.
You know, were in there for the grunt work.
Yeah, I was in there to be, you know, another set of hands who can lift boxes and carry things up three flights of stairs. Yeah, like, nice. But that's what I was there to do. It was, for me, the end result of where I am now was always in the field of vision. And it was, I can't write about something and talk about something and communicate about something if I don't know it in and out and back to front.
So, yeah.
And that's what me becoming a SOM was all about, was understanding that cohesion between food and wine and how that's a different space to wine retail. And yes, you're still talking to people, but it's in a completely different context.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem like it's something that people kind of fall into in many ways, especially like kind of the university thing. Like, a lot of people, like my business partner Tom, he was doing maths and physics in uni before he became a chef. And everyone's always like, oh, that's really strange, when it's actually quite common that people are going to get this little hospo job, fall in love with it, get the rush, and then end up bailing on their quite expensive degree.
Yeah.
And going full time with it. But almost more so than people who went, like, as a young age, I want to work in a bar or I want to work in hospitality. Yeah. Like, you don't really find that. It's always kind of like a second idea, second go, something you fell into and got hooked.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially sort of, I mean, you might see now when it comes to, like, celebrity chef culture and food, like the types of sort of mainstream food media and popularized food media that you see on TV and stuff, people going, I want to be a chef from a very young age. Mm. But, I mean, being at our age, we're all around the same age, I'm guessing.
30s.
Back, 30s. When we were young, there was no... Like, I mean, there was the two fat ladies. I remember they were like the first famous chefs that I knew about. And there was like Consuming Passions and Big Huey on the TV. But no one was like, I want to be like Big Huey. You know what I mean? Like,
no one wants to be like Big Huey.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So, and then I mean, obviously restaurant culture and that sort of thing was completely different as well.
You've seen now, like, I mean, like MasterChef Juniors just started. And there's these like kids who are like 10 and they want to be a chef. Because like cooking in a mum's kitchen.
Yeah, totally.
Like, oh God, you're going to have a fun time in 8 years when you get in a proper kitchen.
But I think it's also like a cultural thing as well. Like, you talk to someone like Kylie Kwong, who I worked with for, you know, a few years, and incredible, incredible chef and incredible person, but she grew up cooking. And you ask, you know, all the Italians who, you know, cooked with Nonna every Sunday and that kind of thing. Like, I think it depends on the culture, but yes, a lot of them that grow up going, oh, I'm gonna be a chef, it's just I love to cook because that's what I do with my family.
I think like you've seen, and you're seeing more young kids seeing chefing as a viable ambition going forward. And I think it's starting to happen with sommeliers, with the Somme films and the kind of prevalence of the quartermaster sommeliers. And it's a word people actually know now. Like, you can say Somme and people genuinely know what you're talking about. Mm. Where even like 5-6 years ago, it wasn't really a word people even used to describe themselves that much. Unless you're like very much in the industry.
Without a doubt. Like, I used to write it when I like travel overseas. It's like, what's your occupation, sommelier? Yeah. And all the customs guys were like, what's that?
Yeah, what do you is do? One of those?
I work with booze. Like, I work with wine and stuff. Mm. And like, oh, great job.
Yeah, exactly.
Come on through. We'll allow you into the country.
Mm. What? Let's talk a little bit about sort of how wine culture and sort of Somme culture has changed since you started back at Manly, Sam. Like, I feel like, and I might be wrong here, but I feel like wine sort of connoisseurship back in the day seemed to be very, like, very narrow to a certain demographic.
Mm.
And it seems to have broadened. Would that be true, do you think?
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And with the advent of sort of, you know, minimal intervention, natural wine, more approachable wines, you know, all those trends have sort of been at the forefront, and it's sort of the younger demographics that are sort of catching on to that. I mean, the thing I've always loved about wine is that you can talk about so many different things through the lens of wine.
Yeah.
So take something like, we can talk about economics and things through the lens of wine for the simple fact that I'll say to you, yes, it's younger people drinking, and the flip of that is we've got less room to be able to cellar wines. People aren't owning as many homes, so it's either a wine fridge or literally a cupboard under the stairs if you've got stairs and that kind of thing, or one of those little wine racks on the end of your dining room table or whatever, which means wine in then turn is being made in a more of a drink now kind of fashion.
Mm.
And all of that stems from us having a wine conversation, but we can extrapolate it out to economic and societal kind of issues because they're all interplayed together.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, like I said, with kind of the natural wine movement,
I'm
going to call it a movement, that's kind of changed the way people talk about wine. It's changed the people who drink wine,
yeah.
Whereas it was seen as very, you know, upper class, rich.
Yeah, white, like, men. I think about my dad and his mates. Like, my dad's a 75, he's 75 now, like, I grew up in Canberra, member of the Canberra Wine and Food Club, where they all put a tie on Saturday night and go drink Shiraz.
Yeah.
Like, and that was them, you know what I mean? It was just older folk and
The Wollongong Food and Wine Association used to do dinners for them at Cabo, and it was there. An interesting snapshot of their demographic.
Yeah, the beef and Bourguignon peeps that would come into Manly Pavilion with like the whole full get-up.
You can predict the bottles they bring as well.
100%.
Like, these guys, they're very Aussie-centric, these guys. So I kind of quite like that. But there was always going to be a bottle of Wins, a bottle of Old Vat One that was probably like stinking and off.
Yeah,
and
the classic ones. Wins, Vat One. There was always some sort of Penfolds, Grange possibly, or it'd be Saint-Henri or RWT or like one of the bin wines under there. Like,
yeah, that's exactly there are, my
there's
dad.
Like a, there's always the Lewin Estate art series in there. Those are the iconics and the classics. Mm. And, you know, to their credit, we can't have what we have now without having those guys blazing the trail first, either that be globally or domestically. Yeah. So
I think it was very much a static, we want to buy these wines, where now, I mean, you see the amount of small, young producers in the last 5 years alone has absolutely exploded.
Mm.
And that's because people are, and it kind of fits into everything, people are more willing to try new things, want to try new things, like want to be the person who's discovered that new wine, that new read, or, you know, whatever it is. And also, like, the natural wine movement ties in with people's caring a bit more about how things are grown, where things came from, how they're being made. So it's all kind of come in with that kind of that culture of being a bit more thoughtful about what you eat and drink.
Can you guys at all, though, like, trace the origins of that relationship between young people and minimal intervention wine, and how this sort of, like, It's trendy as fuck. Let's, like, put it that way. But, like, this trendy as fuck natural wine movement of young people and like labels that's, you know, the Yeti and the coconut with like awesome, cool, colourful labels and beautiful like stuff and quirky names.
Crushing
and
Max.
Or ones on like recycled paper they're drawn by their kids or something. Yeah, or, like, or, Jalma
yeah
or something.
Exactly. And we're not like, it's, you know, we're not shitting on it. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, we love it. But like, what's the origins of this? How did, like, who was first, like, do you guys know who was first on the scene and how this sort of trend began that has this relationship with young people that is so responsible for changing the demographics of wine consumption and the way that it's sort of talked about and understood?
Well, I mean, the origins of the natural wine movement in Australia has always been a testament to, like, the Lucy Margaux's, you know, Tom Shawbrook's, you know, the late Sam Hughes, God bless him. It was always a testament to those guys pushing those boundaries, and, you know, that was kind of like the forefront of that and that ethos. I think the link between the natural wine minimal intervention movement, shall we say, and younger people was because they were the ones that were talking to the younger people. They were the ones that were saying, you know, you don't have to be like your parents and drink these 16%, you know, reds and things like that. We're making wines that are more approachable and of the earth to some extent. I mean, mind you, all wine is of the earth, but focusing on the care and attention that it takes and things like that. And we're not going to talk to you like you're, you know, unknowledgeable or an idiot or anything like that. Like, just come and just try this stuff. It was very much like a, I remember my first tasting with Sam and Tom. They literally came, and Sam was in these tiny pink hot pant shorts that he wore at like every tasting. And they came with this cured meat that they had made in like the winery and things like that. And it was literally Sam, this board, this thing of cured meat, and I think it was like cornichons or pickles or something, and he just had this like huge knife and was just hacking bits of meat off and like shoving it in my face as I'm drinking this wine just to take the edge off. And when you have a memorable experience like that, you're like, yes, I'm going to remember those wines and this experience and these people talking to me, and you know, it makes me invested in what it is that you're doing or trying to do or trying to put forward. And I think that, to their testament, was a huge part of it.
Yeah, look at, I mean, like Tom Shawbrook especially is just very unpretentious.
Yes.
Amazing guy to talk about, like very generous with his time and his words. So I mean, the difference, and you still see it with your kind of wine reps. You see like the older generation and then the younger generation, and the way they talk to you, the way they email you, the way they approach you, the way they like set up meetings and stuff. It's quite stark. And I mean, you know, almost to the point now with the portfolios they work with as well, you can almost look at like a portfolio and kind of work out which kind of person's going to show up when you have a meeting with them. So it's quite a stark difference. And yeah, like I said, like as younger people in the industry, you don't want that sort of pomposity around it. Like you're trying to make your customers have fun and not be overly serious about stuff and enjoy and spend money and have a good time.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of what we're doing. It's not all about the ceremony of everything. So, yeah, I guess it's kind of filtered from the winemakers doing amazing things. I remember stories about those guys. It was the natural wine. What was the little couple of thing they started up together? The natural wine. Those three guys, and they used to like, do little shows, and they just like wander around city restaurants.
It was like a collective.
Theory or something like that. No, something else. I can't remember the name.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's like it's fascinating though, and I wonder. I mean, obviously it's credit to these people, but there's a lot of other stuff, I guess, that plays into it, and probably social media is one of them, and the way that people engage with food and like drinks now on social media, and how that facilitates collaboration between chefs and somms and winemakers and things like that. And there's just this sort of constantly interconnected web of people spreading information and meeting new people and spreading that web further and further and further. But there's also like this interesting transparency when it comes to, you know, Instagram and stuff like that now, where like you can just click on someone and you can get an idea of who they are and who that winemaker is and exactly what they're doing in like real time. And, you know, most people in the hospitality industry, or I'm guessing winemakers as well, are like quite just like open and transparent people, and they just talk about what they do and their platforms that young people use more like disproportionately compared to old people. And people are interested. People just get interested and they get hooked.
I think so especially now, people want the story and want that connection with the sort of winemaker, and social media makes that a lot easier. Whereas before, it was kind of, that was the company, and it was the company you bought off. Now it's very much about the winemaker, as kind of cult of the person you're making it, and, you know, to the kind of the vineyards as well, and the people growing the grapes. So it's kind of, there's that more connection, people get more of that story, and that kind of forges those tight bonds where you can feel a bit more invested in the company if you kind of feel like you know the people behind it.
Yeah, it's a real person behind it. So a lot of the wine training and things that I do with groups of people who, I suppose, don't have a huge amount of experience with wine, the thing I always start off with is saying that one bottle of wine is, as a rough amount, 2.5 kilograms of raw grape material. And it's a minimum of 12 months of somebody's blood, sweat, tears, hard labor. That's one bottle of wine that you probably didn't even think about as you're consuming. It's putting that human element behind the product. And I think, you know, the thing that we, you know, don't always talk about is the overconsumption of wine or the abuse of alcohol and things like that. And when you start to have a conscientious thought behind the product, and I think that's what a lot of natural wine has done as well. Like, it's not a mass produced product like, you know, your Yellowtails of the world or, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So that then in turn, you know, the psychology around it makes you more conscientious of how much you're consuming and having reverence and respect for the bottle that's in front of you.
Does the way that you now work as a sommelier compared to when you first began or earlier in your career, has that adapted with the way that the wine industry's changed and what we're talking about now? Like, does that connection with people and producers get to the table now more than it would have at the beginning?
Yeah, absolutely, without a doubt. I mean, you ask any sommelier, and the way that we sell wine is not telling you what it's going to taste like. It's telling you either where it's from or who made it or something interesting about it. That's how we sell you wine. You know, you've got 30 seconds at best to capture somebody's attention before the eyes roll in the back of their head and they're just like, just put something in the glass. I don't care what it is. So, you know, it's having that down pat of knowing your producers, knowing your regions inside out, all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, being here at Fix, you know, three nights a week, that's how I'm selling wine, is through the story of it or something really interesting.
I think that's, I mean, much for the better as well. Like, naming fruit, like when you're talking about wine, is just probably the worst way to talk about it. Because the person you're giving to, they get to taste it. Like, you can taste it. You can decide what it tastes
it's
like.
It's so subjective.
Like, yeah, and exactly. Like, and so you can't really, I mean, when people are overly specific with, like, flavor profiles of wine, it's like, yeah, that's, I mean, it's great that you picked that, but does it really matter? Like, I get to taste it. You can think that deep about it, or you don't have to. But, like, knowing that, like, you know, where it came from, how it's grown, maybe a little story about the wine, about how it was made, about that vintage, the winemaker, that's like just inherently more interesting to hear and to talk about.
Do you think that with this sort of interest in wine from that younger demographic and stuff, there's a different, like, people taste wine in a different way? Like, I feel like I'm sort of more exposed now to this kind of what you guys are talking about, where it's like, it's not just like, okay, well, this is what I like and this is what I'll drink. You're a bit more just like, I want to try something that sounds interesting and decide on whether I like it, not ask for something that I know I'll like, if you know what I mean. Like, how have you seen the customers' demand?
The way that people buy wine hasn't changed, and I don't think it will change, in regards to they either buy on price, they buy on where it comes from, they buy on the grape variety, i.e. I know I like Sauvignon Blanc. Could I have something that's like Sauvignon Blanc? Because it's still as much education as we do through wine training or through writing about wine and communicating about wine, it still scares the shit out of people. Like, it's still there, regardless of age, gender, demographic. There's still this element of inferiority complex that people have when it comes to wine. It's why you're seeing just normal people not in hospitality aspects doing like wine 101 training or doing their WSET, because they want to feel like they understand and know a little bit more and that kind of thing. So the way people buy wine hasn't changed. The way that they interact with it has.
I don't think people are going to go in a bottle shop and be like, can I get a wine made by the winemaker between the ages of 25 and 32?
Yeah.
Like, I got, people aren't particularly buying wine like
that. Or the buy of label. They're like, oh, that's a pretty label. Yeah, I'll take that kind of thing. So,
so I mean, but I think wine's such a funny one that people... For no reason at all, feel they should know about wine.
Mm.
It is like they, someone who just drinks a couple of wines at home, like, going to a bar and ordering wine. They feel bad they don't know what they're talking about, and it's such a weird thing. Like, you wouldn't do that with like any, like, I wouldn't go in the bank and assume I know. Like, what do you just do?
Those currency rates.
Wine is like, it is quite a sophisticated thing in a way. Like, there's so much to wine. It's a complex and sophisticated. It's an industry. It's a drink. It's farming, essentially. It's art. It's everything. And so that sort of sophistication, I think it's just that people sort of really like. Mm. Maybe not so much is that they feel like they should, but they like to think that they do. It's kind of like if someone like mentions a book by an author that you may have read one of their books, and they're like, oh, talking about a book, and you're like, oh yeah, I read their other book. Like, you just because there's that sophistication that you kind of want to be a part of, if you know what I mean.
It's why, rain, hail or shine, I will always have one heckler at every wine event that I'm ever a part of, whether that be hosting or a part of it. It's always one. And it's not gender specific. There is always one person in the crowd that loves to either tell me or tell the group how much they know about wine. And, and you know, it's been happening for 16 years now. So you've just kind of got to like water off a duck's back. But it's like, yep, you're allowed to be here. It's okay. You're like, it's fine. Like, bravo for knowing everything that you know. Like, it's inevitable.
Yeah.
Like...
Yeah, people just are very funny with it.
Yeah.
I think it also makes for some, like, funny moments, right? I don't know. That you've mentioned in previous conversations, Simon, how it does make for some, like, funny moments at table side when people are trying to sort of express their knowledge and things like that, saying funny things like...
I mean, it definitely happens with the kind of... Probably the one similarity between like younger generation, older generation of winemakers is people still want to drink those specific wines. Like, all the natty wine lovers still want to crush a mag of Radicon, like, compared to someone who wants to sip on a Grange. But it's still very, very much driven by branding, by those, things that are, hard to find unicorn fucking wines.
Yeah, the cult wines.
Yeah, so people are still very driven by that. And you get a lot of, like, young people who... and again, this isn't a criticism, but they don't particularly know much about wine. They just know the wines they want to drink or the wines they want to order, which is the same across things, just the types of wine changes.
Which links back to that sort of social media thing that you were talking about, is what are the wines that everyone are talking about? Like, what are the wines that are, like you said, the unicorn wines, what's hard to get?
Yeah.
All of that kind of stuff. Like, oh, that person's got it. And like, totally. Ooh, exactly. There's wines that I know... Anytime that someone will throw it up on their Instagram stories, it'll get 1,000 likes.
Yeah.
Oh yes, that one. Like, there's a handful of them that you just know that are like instant social media gold.
Well, it's funny too because like as somms, you guys are kind of salespeople in a way as well. Like, you're selling people wine.
If I'm not selling wine, I don't have a job.
Your job is to try to sell people as much wine as you can, basically. Yeah. Like, and good wine, and educate them and all this stuff at the same time. But if there's something that they want, like,
This is a lot of places now we're going for quite specific. Well, places that kind of say that we're a natural wine bar.
Yeah.
For one, I'm always a bit weird. Like, that word gets misunderstood quite a lot. And it's a weird word to use around a product that, like, I mean, you can either say all wine's natural or it's not at all. Like wine doesn't spontaneously, like, fall into vats, just by nature. Like, it's
the minute you've plucked it off the vine, it's suddenly unnatural.
Exactly.
Like,
I mean, then you can even
you've intervened.
Like, yeah, and it's like, well, we're part of nature, so is that like? So it's a weird word to use anyway. But people, if you really want these like very specific wine lists, and I've always been a bit more of like I'll just have like a good spread of wine, and if that's got some Tyrrells and some like Rugabellus, like I like that balance between everything. And then you can suit everyone's kind of palates and need. Then at the end of the day, what you are trying to please the customer.
Yeah.
Yeah, without a doubt. The wine list that I write actually for a little bar out in Enmore called Fortunate Son, which is right opposite Enmore Theatre. The boys there are fantastic, and they just said, you know, we're going to be putting magnums of Krug and Dom on there. So just, you know, we want a well-balanced wine list. You know, it is Enmore, so, you know, put some funky stuff on there. But also we want to be that neighbourhood bar where you can come in and get a glass of Cabernet Sauvignon that's not super green and strict and things like that. So I know for me personally, just from my own tastes, I've never lent too much towards that natty kind of feel. And for me, it's always been about balance, whether that be balance of price points, balance of regions, balance of styles. Like, it's about creating, and that's the hardest part, is creating something that appeals to everybody. And it's not about my personal taste. Like, you know, I've written wine lists where, no, I wouldn't necessarily drink the wine that's on there, but I know that it's good because of whatever criteria that I've painted this wine list with. Like, it holds up to its own merits.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of almost the one of the harder parts, is trying to have your kind of own little brief for your list, and then knowing you what, like, you know, like something like trying to find like an Australian Merlot that's like a bit bolder in this price point, that's quite hard to do now, because these people aren't making that great, but customers will ask for it. So I kind of was one of the things of like, I want, like, at least when someone says, can I have a Merlot, I can give them something.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of people out there, like Brash Higgins makes a cool one, and I was happy to serve that, even though it's very untypical Merlot of what people ask for. I knew they'd be happy because they got their Merlot.
Yeah.
I'm happy because it's a producer I like. So like finding those wines there, that's kind of the hard part. It's easy to stack a list with all these baller bottles you see on Instagram.
Yeah.
It's a lot harder, and you know, in some ways the more laborious part. Trying to find that, you know, trying to find that Pinot Noir for like sub 20 landed, like things like that.
You always got five in your back pocket. There's always things that I know too that are my trusty go-to favorites that'll work on any list because, you know, they're well made and it comes in at the right price. But that's the job of being a sommelier. Like, that is the be all and end all of why somebody has hired me. If I can't write them a list that sells, I have failed at my primary objective
exactly,
being a
sommelier.
Like, I can educate the customers, I can educate the staff, I can, you know, write you a beautiful wine list, but if it doesn't sell, then
it's a waste of paper.
Like, you're just holding up stock that, let's be honest, restaurants can't afford to be holding up. And again, that sort of comes back to my background is working in, you know, my background of having that arts degree was, when you look at an artwork, you don't just take into consideration what's in front of you. You take into consideration the context around it. When was it made? Who's the artist? You know, and what period of time? Are we talking Renaissance art? Are we talking post-impressionism? Are we talking, you know, modern art? All of this, you know, these inflections affect how you view the artwork in front of you. And it's the same with the wine list, and it's the same with the bottle of wine.
How much do you think that your start in the industry has helped you along the way, especially moving into writing, consulting, and things that aren't working the floor?
100 trillion billion percent.
Mm.
I couldn't be who I am and the very, let's say, unique little niche that I've carved out for myself in the industry if I hadn't done the things that I had done. So coming from retail and having that arts degree and that critical sort of art, critical critique sort of degree, moving into, you know, hospitality and being a sommelier, and then from there going to consulting, and then from consulting to writing, and now, you know, education and training and, you know, hosting tours for Wine Australia and everything that I do. You know, we were talking before about, you know, why people get sucked into this industry. It has completely taken over every aspect of my life, and I don't think I could do what I do if it hadn't done, because that's the beauty of it, is, you know, getting to sit here with people like yourselves and, you know, us meeting on social media and things like that, is the fact that that sense of community and family and friendship that permeates the wine and hospitality and food industries. Like, I have more friends now that work in the industry than I do have friends outside of the industry, because literally all my spare time is, I'm either at an event, or pre-COVID I was traveling interstate or out of the country 1 or 2 weeks out of every month on some consulting trip. So it would be going to see friends in other wine regions or things like that, or, you know, going to see friends because they're opening up a new restaurant or something. So
yeah, I mean, it becomes like any, like, so like any holiday is based around like what region haven't I been to
yet? Like, and like, who do I need to go see?
Yeah, like, you know, what restaurant do I want to go to? Like, it's kind of your whole, everything you plan, everything outside of your work life just kind of revolves around it, because there's like a never ending list of things to learn, things to go see, places to visit, and then just the, you know, I think most people into wine are quite curious people, because you have to be, because there's literally an endless amount of shit to learn.
Yeah, the other awesome thing about it, and I know I just get this a little bit from sort of like traveling, doing food stuff while I travel, but is the welcome you get in these places from people that you might not have met before but might have had a bit of contact with on social media or whatever, or you might follow each other on Instagram, just as simple as that. And then you're like, hey, I'm here. And then we're like, just there's this immediate rapport, and you're immediately welcomed, and you get a bit of special treatment maybe here and there or whatever. Like, if it's great.
Yeah, being in industry, like, especially wine, as much as anyone, any kind of part of hospitality, really is a cool community, and everyone's like always very accommodating. Like, you can sort of ring up a winery and be like, oh, hey, I'm gonna be there this weekend, so I've got a sec, and, you know, and you end up like wandering around the winery, having some drinks, having, you know, wandering around the vines. Like, it's just, it's very accommodating, very welcoming, and it's just a nice experience going somewhere and being treated like that, and you know, same as if you go to a restaurant and you get a nice table, and your chef mate comes out and says hello, and all the other people are staring at you, and you're like,
So we'll talk a bit about what you sort of do outside of being a somm. But was the communications and the writing and consultancy sort of intentional from the start? Like, did you say, I want to be a somm, but I also want to do other things in the wine world?
The communication, the writing, yes. I always knew that I was going to write about wine. And the somm background was, again, comes back to that. I can't write about something that I don't know. Yep. That was something that I always firmly believed. So me getting my sort of feet wet in the industry and then going to do, you know, vintages twice a year, you know, since 2013, that was me understanding the whole value chain of how we get from bottle, like, so from grape to bottle, onto somebody's table or in somebody's home. So the consulting thing, that sort of just developed from actually working for Colin Fastnich when we opened up 414, and, you know, fantastic experience, but sort of got home one night and I was like, why am I working 60 hours a week to build up somebody else's brand or line somebody else's pockets? And yes, all the things that I've learned from it, but I'd gotten to a point where it's like, I could be working 60 plus hours and do that for myself. You know, there was a real need, you know, back in 2013 and still now, that, you know, people need sort of education around wine and writing a good wine list. And, you know, there's less and less restaurants that have the finances to have a full-time somm on the floor, so the education around that. So that sort of opening is developed into what it is now.
How did you find it? Like, how did you pursue that into something you can make money out of, essentially?
Asking for a friend.
As a part of a career.
Yeah. asking for a friend.
Yeah. Well, that's like, I mean, I kind of, like, you're here at Fix 3 days a week, like you said, but then you've got all this other stuff happening, and it's like, I'm sort of in this weird position too, where I've got this little publishing business, but I do a million other things, and I don't even know what to tell people when they ask me what I do.
Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like, how long have you got? And it's like 5 minutes and I've just finished my introduction. Like, yeah.
But yeah, like, actually sort of like maneuvering to a position where you can make that a part of your career path. Was that difficult? Was it a challenge?
Look, I mean, there's that old adage where it's like, it takes like 10 years to succeed. So that overnight success that you see takes 10 years. Mm. So I started consulting in 2013 and now it's what, 95% of my income is from consulting and writing and things like that. I think if a post-COVID, well, not really post-COVID, we're still kind of in it, but a post-COVID world has taught me and taught a lot of people that I've had conversations with is how much diversity in your income stream is so incredibly important. Yeah. Like, the amount of messages that I got from people when COVID first hit that just went, it was really smart that you've got five different, you know, income streams, or I really want to go into business for myself because I lost my job or I lost my primary source of income and things like that, and how important it was to kind of do it on your own as much as possible because you've got control over nothing. Like, you can control what you think and how you are as a human being, but everything else is completely out of your hands. So if you can somehow sort of, you know, COVID-proof your finances in your life, then, and whatever that looks like, whatever, you know, drives you and whatever your desire is. So for me, it was wine in all its different, or drinks in all its different sort of facets.
What gives you the most pleasure or enjoyment? Like, is there one aspect of what you do, of the multitude of things that you do, that you like the most, or is having the balance the pleasurable part?
Look, I love everything that I do, because if I didn't, I wouldn't do it. It's that simple. That's how my makeup is. Like, if I don't enjoy doing something, it's really difficult to make me do it. I think the things I love the most and the most enjoyable things are, from an education point of view, like hosting, I suppose, the Sommelier Immersion Trips for Wine Australia, being able to go around the country and introduce, I guess, the next generation of SOMs to these producers or these regions. So, I mean, it's something we haven't really touched on, but my specialty is in Australian wine.
Yeah.
Because that was something that I realized early on. It's like, I can know everything and know little parts of it, which is what, you know, any good SOM can do. Or I can know one thing and know it inside out, back to front, and just really immerse myself in it. And that's what it was for Australian wine for me. So, yeah, and then obviously just the filming side of things. So the filming that we've done with Wine Australia, that we did with Lake Wanaka Tourism, being able to go to these regions and get people excited about what it is that they're creating there, not just from a wine and drinks perspective, but from a produce and a tourism perspective.
Yeah, that's cool.
You know, again, sort of post-COVID, we're kind of trapped here in Australia, and there's so many people that's like, oh, I've never been to X, Y, and Z region that's, you know, on your back doorstep, or that's state over. And if there's anything, it's really exciting to see people doing domestic tourism for that reason.
I mean, even in New South Wales, it's been nice to see people go to the New South Wales regions and visit them rather than going over to Yarra.
Oh, so people's like, I've never been to the Hunter Valley before. Yeah. And I was like, it's only a 2-hour drive.
I lived in Canberra for most of my life, and most people hadn't been to Murrumbateman. Bateman. Yeah. People who lived in Canberra. So, yeah, you should go to Murrumbateman for the day, because it takes half an hour to get there. Like, well, anyway, surprise, surprise. The best bit's the travel. Hey?
Yeah, the best bit's the travel. I know. The bit that took the hardest hit. This is the longest I haven't been on a plane. I haven't been on a plane since February, and it's a weird feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oops, I mean, this is the most I've left Wollongong in like a 3-month period in 8 years, I think. All this time off.
This is my favourite thing. We don't get paid for it, but this is one of the favourite things that out of all the things that I do.
Yeah, for sure.
Hopefully
one
day.
Yeah, it's the reason we do this. Just to have good chats. It's fun.
We'll kind of hit one more thing maybe, and then we'll kind of wrap it up a little bit. But Simon, you wanted to talk a bit about those kind of rose-coloured glasses that people view being a sommelier as, and how it might not be just tasting wine all day, every day.
Again, especially now, it's like, and it's same with people who really want to be chefs because they love cooking at home.
Yeah,
and it's very much different. And it's like, just because you appreciate wine doesn't mean you want to work in an industry, because you've got to deal with customers for one.
Yeah,
and they can either make your day great or make your day horrible. It's a lot of spreadsheet work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you've got to like keep track of your inventory. Like, it's depending how big your wine list is. Like, if you've got a very large wine list, it's a very much a full time job.
Mm-hmm.
And
or if you're writing multiple wine lists,
yeah, exactly. Sam, yeah, so, and it is it goes from, you can spend the whole day sitting on a laptop, ordering, doing inventory, and then suddenly you've got to click, get all dressed up, go on the floor. Mm. In my case, I just have to like get dressed down and go in the kitchen and do like a service, and it's a pretty kind of weird little jump. So it's definitely something that people don't quite understand. So maybe we'd go through a bit of a sort of average day of a sommelier.
Yeah, people spot are on with everything you said, because it's like, I love chocolate, but I'm not about to go work for Cadbury. Like, it's that kind of thing. Like
when you're a kid, you're like, I just want to work in a chocolate factory.
And you get in there and you're like, this isn't what I thought at all. Yeah. Like, what's with all this sanitation gear? Yeah. What do you mean I can't eat it as we go along?
Where are the small people singing the songs?
Where's the river of chocolate? Yeah, all of that. Like, the rose-colored glasses is a really good one. I suppose coming from a background of a not really big drinking family, I didn't have that jump of like, oh, I really love wine, so I'm going to go work in the wine industry. It was, I'm really interested in wine and all the things around it, so I'm going to go work in the wine industry. Yeah, it's a lot of spreadsheets, like you said. It's a lot of math, which I was not expecting at all. Oh, my God. Sorry.
You're right.
Another booking for tonight. Yeah, no, sorry. Yeah. You can't come with 20 of you.
You're saying it's a lot of math.
It's a lot of math.
Yeah. Because they don't make invoices easy. The sums.
No. Like WET and GST and... Yeah. Yeah. No.
Tom, my business partner, has just started kind of dealing with them a bit more because we're sort of sharing the duties at Parrot. And he just keeps bringing me over and he's like, so how much this one cost? And I'm like, just go on that one and just add your GST and you'll be fine. He's like, what's this one then? I'm like, I still don't know. I ignore that one. It's fine. Like, it seems to get paid fine. So we'll just keep going with it.
Just look at the total.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just make sure that gets paid and we'll be fine.
We'll sort it out later.
After that, it's good.
Yeah. So, a lot of math, because obviously we work on cost of goods and things like that and making sure that we're selling things at the right prices. Prices keep going up and there's only so much room that we've got to be able to sell wine, especially with online retail and looking at other restaurants. So there's all of that. And then obviously there is the tasting wine part, because it changes every year. Like, this wine that you've loved for 3 years straight, something's different, or they've changed something, and or the vintage was different, and there's all of that. And then the working on the floor, you know, dealing with people and the nuances of people, shall we say. And there's, that element as well. And then, glasses.
Polishing glasses.
Like, trade tastings are a bit of a marathon. And it's a lot of time.
I want to come to the next. Can I somehow come to the next one?
Yeah, I think it's all sneaky in.
Yeah, I've heard so much about trade tasting days, and I'm like, I need to experience this.
It's not like a wine festival. Like, and it's like the best, especially like me coming from Wollongong. We don't get as many people coming down.
Yeah,
especially in the first couple of years, I used to come up to like almost everyone, and sometimes I'd have to get back for work at like 6.
That's rough.
And it'd be like, and sometimes there's like 250 of wines, and you can't taste them all.
Yeah.
You have to be selective. But after you've done 20 reds...
How's your mouth feel after that?
Not great.
Yeah.
No. Not great. Like, it's like tough on your palate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially when you start hitting some reds and then you maybe go to like some Italian producer and you're like, great. I'm going to be tasting these for 3 days now.
Yeah. Definitely cherry pick. Definitely spit.
Yeah.
That's my advice for young soms, especially as one who, when she was 18 and went to her first trade tasting, it was one of those massive ones at the Sydney Convention Centre. I tried spitting for the first time, got it basically halfway down my chin, and I was like, okay, well, we're not doing that again. And ended up swallowing everything for an hour and a half straight, where I actually had to get wedged between two of my co-workers. We were standing at the Henschke table, and Prue Henschke, the queen of everything Henschke, is standing in front of me, and I was like, hi, and then literally wedged between two people because I was like swaying, and they were just like, just don't embarrass us, just get through it. So yeah, I highly recommend spitting.
yeah, it's and again, they are fun, it's great, and it's amazing to taste that much wine for free. And it kind of is the only way you can really learn about wine is by tasting as much of it as possible and talking to either the reps, or if you're lucky enough, talk to the makers and the producers. Like, that's the biggest opportunity of things like that. And that is like one of the one of my favorite things is getting the opportunity to talk to winemakers, having them open a one-on-one time, get your little weird questions that you've had in the back of your mind answered.
The one-on-one time with 50 other people at the table. So you're like, I just have to ask this question really quick.
Yeah, just get one in quickly and get your attention. but I mean, yeah, especially for me, I'd come up on the train in the morning, crush a load of wine.
And then what time do they start?
And midday.
Oh, okay. That's not too bad.
Yeah.
Later than?
It's like, it's usually midday. It's usually out. It's like in between services. Some of them will start at 10 so they can get like the first bits from like 10 to 12. Mm. And then they'll be like, it'll run to like, you know, 6 because then you'll get the post lunch service people kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's a long day.
Yeah.
Like,
All right, we'll start to wrap it up. Is there anything about the wine industry, wine culture, that is an issue that you would like to see change? Like, how would you? I mean, it's developed so much, and we've talked about that. But what are some sort of things about the industry that you'd like to see change? Like, if you think about a utopian wine culture in the future, what do you want to see?
There's quite a few.
You okay? You're going to throw me under this bus first. Okay. So I know I can't badmouth the industry that I basically make my entire living from, and I won't, because I do truly love it. It's funny, when we were talking about this podcast months ago and you had said, do you want to talk about sexism in the wine industry? And I thought about it and I was like, oh no, it's all fine. But then a few months on, and I've actually had time to think about it and I've had some sort of experiences, and I realized that, and it's, you see it obviously in chefing culture as well, but when we talk about sexism in the industry, it's never as in your face as you expect. It's quite subversive and it's quite sort of under the surface there. And so my instant reaction is like, no, there's no sexism in the wine industry. I've had every opportunity. I've, you know, look at where I've come from, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But it's the subtle things like that boys club culture that permeates through every industry globally, not just hospitality and wine and food. It's the thing that we're always battling against, and we're always going to be battling against until, you know, that utopian society where there's true equality and things like that. If anything I could change, it would be that, and having to fight twice as hard for every opportunity that I've gotten, which in some cases have been handed to men who are less qualified than myself.
Okay.
And just, you know, the underhanded sort of comments that you get from strangers and from people that you know at tables where they think they're being really funny and they're very much not. You know, I'll use an example of, I was actually working here a few weeks ago and I was serving a group of some very well-known winemakers, and all jovial, all fun, you know, people that I know and respect. And one of them out of the blue goes, oh, I heard you're fucking such and such in the middle of the table in front of all my peers. In what planet is that in any way appropriate that you think that you can get away with that? But you do, because you're a guy and I'm a young female, and, you know, you all think that it's fun and games. But in some ways, it's you're trying to erode the power that I'm trying to build for myself and the brand and all of this kind of stuff. And in that situation, I'm in a lesser power position because I'm here serving you as a song. You know, so it doesn't matter all the other stuff that I achieve and everything that I do. There's always going to be someone that goes, I'm just going to knock you down just a little bit because of their own stuff. So it was very much like, no, you know, laughed it off, made the joke, tried to smooth it over, all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah, that's the thing that I would change.
Yeah, and unfortunately we still are in this, like you were saying, the power dynamic there is like, you're serving people and stuff and you're working, and it's like, yeah. I mean, in an ideal world, you say, hey, get the fuck out.
Yeah.
Like, or whatever, yeah. You know, and the fact that we're not there yet yeah. as well is a part of the issue. And I think that, like, I mean, this is a we can talk about this as a whole nother podcast. And it's something that Simon and I kind of talked about before we did this podcast, because you've done a lot of work when it comes to, you know, identifying these issues and stuff like that. But when we do our podcast, like, especially like when we've got female guests, we don't necessarily want to just fucking always make it about the fact that
yeah.
you're female. Yeah. Like, yeah. why is that actually an issue? Let's talk yeah. about wine. Like, yeah. let's talk about what you yeah, so what
we,
you love.
We spoke right after we kind of had that idea, and I was like, I was thinking about a topic we could talk about, yeah. like something that wasn't just kind of surface. And afterwards, I was like, we're just asking that because we're talking to a sommelier who happens to be
yeah, a female.
Yeah.
So that kind of changed our perspective. And I did quite a lot of research in it as well. And it was one of those things where, like, we've mainly had, like, female front of house staff. So we've always had lots of stories from them and, you know, yeah. experienced things and had to, you know, give customers some shit or, like, ask them to leave when they've been rude. And even, like, literally the other day, like, some old dude asked our, like, front of house staff if she was, like, Tom's wife. Like, there was no reason that she would be. And just, like, this old guy just was like, well, you're here, you must be someone's wife.
Yeah.
And it was just one of those little ones. Just like, what, like, why would you... Why would that even matter? Like, what was it? You've just been an asshole the whole night anyway. So, yeah, it's definitely something we kind of thought about. And the one statistic which I found, which quite surprised me and might surprise kind of a lot of other people, where hospitality is said as this very male-dominated industry. And at a lower level, it's actually not. It's actually majority women.
Yeah.
It's when you go up that it sharply declines in representation when you get to, like, the CEO level. And that's kind of where the...
Like a lot of other industries.
Well, yeah, yeah. Exactly. But actually, hospitality, like, much worse. Like, there's a higher
It's indicative of the world at large anyway. Yeah. It's not just for us. And it's not that I'm a female som and, you know, Jackie that you had on, you know, last week. Not that she's a female chef. You know, again, we've earned everything that we've done in our own right, but you're asking things that I would change, and that would be one of them. Yeah. Like, it's twice as hard to get the same opportunities. And I think as well, when we talk about money and things like that, you know, it's all, I suppose, to, you know, whenever I go into contract negotiations with new clients or things like that, it's generally my male friends that I'll speak to for points of reference and things like that, because, you know, systematically women don't fight as hard for raises and things like that. And it's only, you know, being in business for myself since 2013 that I've gotten really good at contract negotiations and not being bullied, because, like you said, those top tier people are still men. So they are the men that I'm going up to and going, this is what I'm worth, here is all the experience, here's everything that you want, I will deliver it to you on a silver platter, but this is what it's going to cost you. And, you know, it wasn't always the figure that it is now, but you build up to that and you talk to your peers, male and female.
Exactly.
And the more that we're open and honest about the situations that we're in and the experiences that we're having, the more it brings it into the light, and then we start getting closer towards equality. I think because a lot of it's still in the shadows and the thing that's hidden 100%. Away and nobody talks about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, I just think that these discussions, if we're talking about changing this such important issue, it's just talk about it, understand it, and change, and you know, continue down the path.
I think the wine isn't, like I said, doing kind of bad-mouth the industry. I think the wine industry is in pretty good shape as within tolerance and acceptance, and, you know, there is some amazing, you know, winemakers who are women in Australia. And, you know, sommeliers and, you know, kind of every level. So it is in a pretty good place, but there's still that, yes, that underlying shadowy,
like kind I said, of
not
when we,
spoken about.
When we first had that conversation, I was like, oh, there's not. And then it's when you think about it and you think about just the subtle things that happen. That's that's what it is. And it's like that in any industry.
It's like that in culture.
My stories are not unique to me. Yeah. Like,
in any industry or any culture, and that's you know, the sexism and inequality that's the cornerstone of it is the stuff that people say behind closed doors that they actually kind of still think is okay and yeah. still think yeah, 100%. You know,
well, I think they think that the problem isn't them thinking that, the problem is them not being allowed to state that overtly. Yeah. Like, to them it's like, why do I have to say this behind closed doors?
Mm.
Yeah. But they know that they're going to get some backlash, which, I mean, is the first step. People know they're going to get backlash from saying these things or thinking these things or acting this way.
Yeah,
that's one step to pushing out of it.
And
I think the push for more representation across the board in the wine industry, from, you know, people of color to you know, different you know, all kind of
backgrounds and diversity, yeah, and exactly, all of that, yeah,
is the kind of next push to have. I think definitely with the Black Lives Matter movement recently, that kind of made me go like, how many people of color do I know in the wine industry, or like how many winemakers or viticulturists I know who have Aboriginal background? And it was kind of a bit stumped on that as well. So it was definitely something I was like, how can we sort that in some way, or help, like what can be done in that respect?
Yeah.
So that's definitely something that it'd be cool to see change, especially with a lot of vines being planted on country.
Yeah.
That's something that I'd definitely like to see some change.
And acknowledging
with
those traditional names.
Yeah, exactly. Land.
Like,
yeah,
I know that I'm starting to see it a lot more, especially in more people's bottles, email footers and back labels and things like that. It's something that, you know, so I suppose you're getting an exclusive here, but I, from January, will be Gourmet Traveller, Australian Gourmet Travellers, for the food magazine's drinks writer. So I'll be there. I'll have a monthly column with them, and that's something that we'll be focusing on, is each Australian region that we're talking about each month. We will state the traditional Aboriginal Indigenous name for that site. So for the Riverland, for the McLaren Vale, for the Hunter Valley, all of that. So to start putting it into people's vernacular, to start putting it front of mind for people, and acknowledging that we are on land that was never ceded.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's like you said, it's small incremental changes, but it's at least we're going in the right direction. We're moving forward in some positive, healthier way.
Mm. Cool. Anything else you want to mention before we wrap it up? Simon, I was asking Sam that question, but it sounds like you've got something to say.
I just had when you're like, what things you like to change? There's like some stuff I'm like, I'd really like to change. And other things I'm like, that's a bit of an annoyance to me. I was just trying to pick one that would be.
You want to give us one? Go on, give us one.
So that's why I was like, I was like audibly thinking there. So I was like trying to narrow it down.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's like people who are into wine but haven't done that little bit of kind of research knowledge building, when they're just like, fucking love wines, love going to wine festivals, love smashing natty wines.
Yeah.
Just love, like, probably don't even really know what natural wine actually is, or a decent definition of it. and are just all about it, and their whole Instagram's full of it. Without actually kind of knowing a little bit more. And
going to that extra length.
Just taking a little bit of time to actually, you know.
Yeah.
We do a whole other podcast on like wine influencers that you see on Instagram. I mean, and you're like, you're killing me. Yeah, like the amount of people that like have come to events or things that I've hosted, whether it be through Pinapalooza, and love them for resharing and things. And I've had to like slide into DMs and be like, that's not what I said, or that's not what carbonic maceration is, you've sort of misunderstood this. Let me just sort of correct that for you, and maybe don't, you know, post that out to your 40,000 followers.
It's going to be wrong.
You know, I mean.
Right. So this is a world I'm not exposed to, the wine influencer world. Right?
Wine chat part two.
Yeah. There's a weird like celebrity kind of winemaking thing happening.
Oh, the Cameron Diaz clean wine.
Yeah. And,
wow. Okay. Yeah.
There was one actress, I can't remember the name, but she, she describes herself as a winemaker. What's her name? She was in 51st Dates with Adam Sandler.
Drew Barrymore.
Yeah. Yes. She describes herself as a winemaker. Yeah. She has her own wine label.
She had this whole Vogue article. Yeah. I remember reading it and cringing.
And she said like, her description of how rosé was made was just one of those ones like,
oh,
like,
you peel the skins off.
Yeah, that was
you
peel the skins off. It's like, no, like that's
that,
not
what that was published.
Yeah, it was
published in Vogue.
What?
She did a whole article of how she was a winemaker and that she makes rosé by peeling the skin off the grapes, and then making wine. But it's the whole Cameron Diaz clean wine movement thing. It's it's marketing. It's, yeah. You could... The thing about wine, especially in Australia, and to our benefit, and I say this in a positive sense, is that we don't have appellation controls like France or like Italy. We don't have AOCs, which means we have always been at the forefront of innovation because we can make wine out of anything, anywhere, good or bad, you know, all the rest of it. We've got label rules, which are perfect, you know, so that you know what it says on the label is what you get. But everything else is up for grabs. Yeah. So it means that in some ways you can market things however you want.
Yeah,
and this is done all over the world. Mm. So they're taking, you know, the whole natural wine movement, we talk about it in a, you know, this is new wave and things like that, but it's been around for centuries.
Yeah.
Like 8,000 years ago, you know, Georgia, uninterrupted vitis vinifera history, making wine like we do in natural wine movements now.
Yeah.
So you take that spin and you can turn anything and yeah, There's some doozies out
less
there.
Less bullshit then. Less of the bullshit puffy marketing like we see in a lot of things.
Just people just admitting that they have gaps in their knowledge or they don't know something. Like,
yeah, that's a nice thing too. That's just a bit of transparency about what you know.
Humility.
Yeah, that's what I kind of key in everything.
Like, that's what we kind of try to do a little bit with this podcast. Is like when we don't know something, especially me, I'm the first to admit that I don't fuck all and about
like,
wine.
I'm always like. It's kind of in stages in my wine learning as well. I think, oh my God, I've got a pretty good grasp here.
Yeah.
And then like, it was like a few years ago. I remember like the first time I like just reading about different clones of vines and we're just like, oh, for fuck's sakes. Yeah. I was like, oh, have I got to learn this now?
Yeah.
And like, it's just another complete massive, like, whole different subject. It's, you know, it's suddenly agriculture and
I feel like we're coming full circle because the first thing that Ian, my bottle shop manager at Vintage Cellars, told me, he goes, if there's one thing that you walk away knowing, it's this. The first thing you know is that you know nothing.
Yeah.
There you go.
And it will always be that way. Like, I will always be learning something new or I'll make a mistake and have to, you know, retrain my thoughts on what it was. But the joy of the wine industry is that you get to keep learning and you get to keep developing and finding new things and tasting new things. And that's the exciting part. And I think the minute that I stop being excited by that is the minute that I hang up my corkscrew and go, you know what, we're done. Like, I'm not excited by this anymore.
Wow. All right. Well, you just ended the podcast absolutely perfectly.
Yeah.
Sam, thank you so much for joining us for a food fight.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome to talk. Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's Simon_Evans_TBD on Instagram. Thanks so much for tuning in and we'll catch you again with another episode.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.